BBC Sounds.
Davy Scott here with another bonus episode of Classic Scottish Albums from BBC Radio Scotland. This week, we've been celebrating 10 short songs about love by Gary Clark. Gary joined me in our Glasgow studio for a walk down a memory lane which took in Dundee, London, and, believe it or not, Ramsay Street. Just thinking about that journey from those first two Danny Wilson records and how you got to 10 short songs about love. So what was that process? You know, the end of Danny Wilson and the start of this, really?
Well, there's sort of two processes. One's the writing of the album, and some of it had started because in a way this was going to be my version of a third Danny Wilson album. And the one of the big problems with Danny Wilson is that initially I was really the only writer. Kit did some stuff for his own band, but by the time we got to making album three, or talking about making album three, Jed was writing, Kit had written loads of songs, and it meant that I was going to have to either diminish what I was doing, or it was going to be some triple album or something. And that was certainly one of the problems, you know. And I actually remember demoing, like, really rough Porter Studio demo of certainly St. Jude, maybe something else that ended up on 10 Short Songs with Danny Wilson. So some of the songs had been in, you know, brewing to be part of what would have been a third Danny Wilson album. When the band split up, I was held on at Virgin Records. They wanted to keep me on as I was the singer and main songwriter. And me and basically my A&R man became my manager, Ronnie Gurr. And we sort of thought that it was time to move on from there. And so we talked to Virgin Records about getting me off. And they did a really, really reasonable deal, actually, which had a little bit of an override if I signed with another label. And then there was a period of, I would say it was about a year of me sort of collecting the songs, demoing them, and trying to get a new deal. And I eventually settled on a company called Circa that were pretty new company, but they were really on the zeitgeist at the time. They had Tricky, Massive Attack. They had Hue and Cry was the only other Scottish. Actually, they had Billy McKenzie as a solo artist at one point. Maybe before or after that. But I loved that label, and they had this little office where everybody could see one another, and it was just really vibing. It was like the really early days of Virgin. Pretty much as soon as I'd finished the album, the two guys that ran Circa were asked to take over Virgin Records. So the album ended up kind of being processed through Virgin Records again. Well, not kind of, definitely. You know, I was ended up going back to that building. And so it was a kind of interesting roundabout journey to end up back pretty much on Virgin Records.
Yeah, and I mean, there's another nature of the transition in that you still have Jed as a big player in this record, and Kit's there in terms of the vocals as well. Mm-hmm. So I'm just trying to work out from my own experience of band dynamics how that felt now being in your record with people essentially working on it.
Well, you see that none of us ever fell out, Danny Wilson. Obviously, Kit was my brother. We fall out all the time, but not about that, you know. And Jed and I had been making music since we were at school together. We're best pals. So there was no animosity whatsoever. We all had loads of respect for one another. And as I say, it was really me trying to make what I would have seen as the third Danny Wilson album, but that I couldn't make if we'd have stayed together, because it would have been a very different record with all the different contributions. I'm not saying the contributions would have been bad. It just wasn't the record that I wanted to make. So so they were the obvious kind of choices for me, really. But the big thing about this record for me, or the big life change thing about this record for me, is that I'd saw the amount of money that Danny Wilson was spending in big studios like the Townhouse, and really hundreds of thousands of quid going into these studios. And I'd been getting into recording a lot at home on 4-track studios, and I even had like some kind of Akai 8-track thing or something. And I'd worked a lot in studios doing demos and things, and I basically decided that if Circa were up for it, that I would take my advance that would have normally been spent in these big studios and put a studio in at my house, which was a flat, actually, in Kensington. And one of my best pals was the trumpet player in Danny Wilson, Gary Thompson, was also a recording engineer, and he was really into electronics, and he was really up on all that stuff. And he said to me, we can do this, the two of us together, you know. And so we took the advance and basically built, we got a room soundproofed, and we basically built a studio. And I still remember really clearly for me, there was something about the process of going through that year without a record deal. And I just felt, I don't ever want to be beholden to a record company again. If I want to make a record, I want to be able to make a record whenever I want to make a record. So there was a part of me thinking ahead. Nowadays, obviously, everybody can make a record on a laptop, but at that time, you needed a serious amount of equipment to achieve it, you know. And so that's how we did it. We did the whole thing in a flat. There's not a lot of personnel on it, you know.
I was going to ask about that as well, and I will come back and talk a wee bit more about the production, because it's such a feature, I'll ask you to do, ask everybody to do, which is put us in that space, and we'll come back to that. But it is, even just looking at the credits afresh, it is just like basically on most tracks it's just three, isn't it? And you're playing, like, you know, seven instruments on some tracks and all of this, so. What was that experience like in terms of Danny Wilson? I know that it was quite tight in Danny Wilson as well, but you did also bring in session players now and then, and there was a bit more of a cast there.
Mm-hmm.
So for you, was it important to be the kind of auteur in that sense, where you're kind of playing the mandolin and you're working out the guitar parts or whatever?
Yes, in the sense that it really was me trying to take control of that side of making records and also improve myself as a producer and all that stuff. But there's another element of it, and that is just that we'd spent all the money on equipment. And it was literally, okay, we've got to do this, and we've promised to make a world-class record here. We've got to make it, you know. So, you know, the key players, musician-wise, were Gary Thompson, as I've mentioned, who was also working as an engineer. I mean, he had a really early version of Pro Tools called Sound Tools that only had two tracks, so we used it mainly for effects. But and then Jed. So we got basically we put aside money for Jed, Carlos Edwards, who was the percussionist, and Danny Wilson, who was also a really good drummer. And then I had a bit extra kit, came and played some accordion and stuff. But they were the main players. And the idea was that they would be on call and we could just make the record at our own pace, which was also part of the beauty of having your own studio, you know. But that whole year was that record, you know.
And it's got that. It has got its own very distinctive sound. Jed is a real rock, isn't he, in terms of his musicality?
Massively. I mean, most of the drum programming is Jed, and the drums are quite distinct on that record, I think. Carlos would play live hi-hats and stuff to sort of loosen it up, and percussion and things, but a lot of the drums are programmed on that record, and I would say 99% are programmed, and a lot of that is Jed, and of course his bass playing. See, the thing about Jed, Jed's one of the grooviest, tightest bass players you'll ever experience in your life. He's like solid as a rock. And so I wanted that rhythm section thing to be really, really solid. And that's kind of what Jed really took care of, that side big time, you know.
And it's one of the things, isn't it, that probably does start to make 10 Short Songs About Love distinctive in comparison to the two Danny Wilson records that preceded it, in that suddenly the groove is more of a thing. And Danny Wilson records have got fabulous grooves, but this is more of an R&B record. It's more of a soul record.
Yeah.
And it is more confident about its kind of, it's more confident about its groove, if that makes sense.
I think that's true, yeah.
And are you thinking, I want to go there? Or is that where the
group, songs were going there? I mean, a big thing that had happened for me is, like, first Danny Wilson record, I actually played all the piano on it, but I'd never owned a piano. I had to learn the parts from my guitar in the studio, and I'd do a lot of drop-ins and stuff. By the time I'd written the songs for 10 Short Songs, I'd bought a piano and I'd got good enough on it at least to write songs. And the magic, as you know, Davey, very well, of piano, if you're into kind of harmony, like chords, which I always was, is the piano is an amazing instrument to discover new things on. I'm still not great on the piano, but to write songs on it, it's an amazing, as you know, Davey, you like me, love harmony and chords. I'm even making the movements with my hand. You won't be able to see that on the radio, but the piano just makes you reach for things that you don't necessarily even know what they are. You kind of got a clue what they are, but for me, it's a very freeing instrument. That's what I found about it. And I think you can hear that in the chords in 10 Short Songs. They don't seem to be really rooted in key. They're more rooted in where the next chord wants to take you. And so that was a huge influence on the sound of the record, I think, the chords.
Yeah, that's great. For me, that's great to hear that, because it just squares going back to the record, particularly, and I'm thinking about the singles, Stormy Waters and Free Floating, where you suddenly go somewhere totally else for a middle eight, and that's a real piano thing. Mm. Is that something, I mean, is that was present in your writing before, there's always that kind of complexity in your writing. Are you saying that was partly the outgrowth of the sort of piano experience?
I would say that 10 Short Songs was the first confident piano record where I'd sit for hours and hours and hours at the piano exploring that. Whereas I'd say that the records before, it starts, particularly the first record, all the songs were written, with the exception of Five Friendly Aliens, which was written in the studio on the piano. The songs were written on guitar and then translated to the other instruments. And I'm first and foremost a guitar player. Well, that was, you know, my initial instrument, and I'm probably best on guitar. So the piano, me not being quite as certain on it or where I was going, instead of that being a limitation, was a real freer for me. I could just follow what I was kind of imagining in my head, and sometimes hit a chord that I'd be like, what the heck's that? You know, I've actually got a great story about the song St. Jude, which starts with this figure on the piano, and I, a third chord or whatever it is, I think it's a C major 7, but I've got an F in the bass. And that's, we were doing a session at the BBC, and this was when the BBC, at this point, there was still a lot of the producers that had been around sort of since the 60s and things, and the guys were wearing like white coats and stuff. And this was in London, and it was a big, beautiful studio. I can't remember the name of it, Maida Vale or something. But I get behind the piano and I start the intro to the song, and I go down, 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 and a minute I hit that chord, I get the tape stop, and the guy says, "Go again." And I'm like, okay, so I start again. And I get to that chord, and it's like, and take three, you know. So and I go again, and I said, excuse me, do you mind telling me why you keep stopping? Because I don't understand. And he goes, well, and he was clearly a really musically educated guy. He says, ah, you're playing a C major 7, but there's an F in the bass. And I said, yeah, I'm sorry, but that's the way it's got. That's what I wrote, you know. So
that is funny.
But those accidents or those things that are not strictly in the rule book are the magic of really not fully understanding an instrument and kind of just going for it. You know,
it's funny, isn't it? Because when you talk about sort of complex music or sophisticated music, there is always that tendency to think that there is great schooling behind it. But sometimes it is that it's almost like a primitive entry to music that produces those things. Is that generally a part of your writing process, Gary? Even today, do you still try and follow that?
I think the thing for me was that when I was growing up, my dad liked jazz and swing, so I grew up with that very rich, without me even thinking about it, rich harmonic. You know, the chords were ninths and major sevenths and all that stuff. I kind of know a bit more about it now, obviously, but I still don't read dots, but I... So in my head, it was just what I wanted to hear. And the instrument, I was trying to use the instrument to try and figure out how to make that noise that I was hearing in my head. And then as you go, you know, you obviously get knowledge, but I was never schooled in it. But I was schooled in the sense that I grew up with pretty sophisticated music. So I had kind of, I had that in my DNA, you know.
Yeah. Let's talk about the sort of conceptual nature of the album. I mean, you spoke earlier on about it taking almost a year to figure out what your record was going to be. And clearly the title, you know, 10 Short Songs About Love, suggests some kind of concept, but it's there in the music, and there is all of those themes of love, breakup, resolution, all those kind of things. So did you set out to tell this story from the start when you were writing the songs, or did it emerge from the...
It emerged, and not only that, as I would say that I was at that time living in London, a lot of my inspiration came from cinema. I used to go and watch far too many films, and I'd go during the day when the cinemas were completely empty and quiet, and sometimes I'd go and see 3 films a day, you know. And even the title comes from that. There was the Kieslowski Decalogue, which the short film about killing, short film about love, blah, blah, blah. And so it was more influenced by that. Like, I liked the idea of a sort of thematic thing. I liked the idea of music that linked the songs, and I liked the idea of it feeling like kind of one piece. In terms of the lyrics, they would have been written at slightly, you know, they would have been written over a period of time, so there was no kind of, it wasn't like a concept album, I guess is what I'm saying. It's just that when you look at the whole thing, they're all songs about in one way or another. They're actually about humanity. It could have been as easily called 10 Short Songs About Humans, you know, but it wasn't a concept album, I guess is what I'm saying.
Let's talk through some of the individual songs. Let's start off with the opening track, This Is Why, Jay, which is such a dramatic, you know, it's not a warm hug to start the record. Talk to us about that, about the song itself, the decision to kick the record off with that.
That grew out of my brain. I heard that in my head before. It wasn't something that I sat at the piano and jammed. It was something that I had to go to the piano and work out what it was that I was hearing in my head. And I wanted something that, again, something that was really filmic, quite dramatic, to open the record. You know, lyrically, it's a lost love thing. I actually stole my friend Janet, we used to call her Jay, so I actually stole her name as a... There is no real Jay apart from Janet, but we never went out together or anything. But I just wanted something that felt like a Bond movie or something, you know, like something big and glamorous, I guess.
Yeah, and I mean, it definitely sort of hits and holds the tension and gives weight to, I think, was it the first single, We Steal in Stormy Waters? Okay, so that to me is one of the sort of most uplifting sort of things on the record. It's interesting you use that sailing as maritime metaphor, which is something you've done more recently and elsewhere as well, I think, Gary. Talk to us about that song. Where did the song come from?
So
some reflections on its recording.
Well, lyrically, that one's very personal. I'd just met my wife, Alison, just before the start of making of this record and during the writing of this record. And her father was actually a sea captain. And my family, coming from Dundee, have a lot of whalers, you know. So it sounds like it's abstract writing, but it's actually true, a lot of it. And it was just, we're embarking together on this life and, you know, we're going to hit some stormy waters, but we're going to get through it, you know. And I'd been listening to a lot of Beach Boys, which you could probably tell from the whole album, because I listened to it again today for the first time in ages because I knew we were doing this talk. And I was struck by how much vocal harmony there is in it. I'd kind of forgotten how much that is, which is all me kind of tracking myself up. But that was coming from that whole Brian Wilson, Beach Boys kind of influence. And then the only other thing I'd say about that song that I've always found, I love music that makes you feel really joyous, and yet I think it's the most difficult music to write, because it's right on the edge of being corny or right on the edge of being daft or something, you know. And so when I always strive to kind of somehow express joy in a lot of songs, and I think that's a really good example of that feeling. When I'm sitting playing the piano, I feel joyous when I'm playing it, and it's, you know.
Yeah, it is joyous. A wee train spotter question just for me. And you. I actually remember when it came out, and I didn't just think the Beach Boys. I wondered if you'd heard Brian Wilson's 1988 solo record.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. I love that record.
Oh, me too. I mean,
you know, Love and Mercy and all that stuff.
Yeah, you know, it had that kind of, that sort of marriage between that sort of template of arrangement that he sort of set in the 60s, but with really contemporary machines and production and all
well,
that.
Well, actually, yeah, I mean, I guess that record, which, as you say, is probably three or four, maybe 4 or 5 years before 10 Short Songs, would have been a record that I would have played a lot at that time. And also, there was a Scott Walker record around that time as well that I played a lot. Climate of Hunter,
Climate of Hunter,
which again, to go back to the first song, This Is YJ, that's got that kind of Scott Walkery kind of thing as well. I mean, I guess as well with it, it's, these songs are great to sing, you know. A lot of it is just enjoying singing, you know.
Well, it's funny you say that, because the next one on my list, again, just and we'll go through, I think, most of the songs on the record and if we've got time. But the Free Floating, I mean, talk about something that's fun to sing. Again, I listen to that, I think, God, I wish I was on that record. it's got that sort of that freeing thing. And you spoke earlier on about the piano as a writing instrument being very freeing. The song Free Floating itself is kind of just lifts off the planet.
That's a super piano-y record, song as well. It took quite a long time to write because it's quite musically complex, but I knew what I wanted it to be in the first place. You know, like, first time I sort of got the idea, I kind of knew where I wanted it to go. But there's a lot of modulation in it and stuff that needed to be really finessed. So the chords really had to be thought about, and I think by the end of it, I was able to sit back and listen to it and go, that really works, you know. But
yeah, it's got, I mean, you're talking about the sort of complexity of it and the way that all of that musical complexity is finessed, but structural as well. You've got that little bit where you go to the middle eight and it sort of turns around back into the song in quite an unexpected way. I'm wondering if that was maybe part, given what we know about writing for and with other artists, if maybe that was the start of a process that set you on the road that you took later on. You know, that very careful, I'm not sure if I'm putting this correctly, I think you probably know what I mean, but for listeners, the way that pop music can be structured in quite nuanced ways to get from A to B, the listener doesn't necessarily notice it, but there's a lot of structure and architecture there.
It's the craft, isn't it? But I would say that, and it should be invisible, the craft, even though we're talking about it right now, but I would say that when I started writing for other artists, the big trick for me was learning to simplify, because the big lessons for me were always in that. And I think I'm actually doing that more and more, like less chords, less, you know, and really clear lyrical points of view. And, you know, but when you're a young artist, I was like in my early 20s, and I was kind of happened to be lucky enough to be working at a time that the music business was in good shape. The CDs were booming and there was money in the business that there isn't anymore. And it was a great time to be making records because you were given a lot of freedom. We were literally just go away and do what you want to do, you know. There was very little outside influence. And so it was like, I was in a sandpit just enjoying myself. And that's reflected in that sort of freedom, you know, that just not really... Because I wanted Free Floating to be catchy, but I also wanted it to be complex. A lot of my superhero influences, people like Steely Dan or Todd Rundgren, they somehow managed to make things that are sing-along. You can't get them out of your head. But if you were to sit down and try and play them, you'd need a degree. And
so true. Well, but on the other side of the coin, I think another thing that really, really sets this record out are the three or four things that just go like that, boom, right between the eyes. And the one that stands out for me is Make a Family.
Right.
And at the time, I remember when I had this record, that was one, listen to this album in the kitchen, I just turned it up a wee bit. It just got that, there's a good-heartedness about it, a directness. And I'm wondering if you were maybe thinking, you see, you just met Alison those days. Is that a song that is rooted in your own experience? Is it something that you...
Absolutely. At that time, there was a chance that we might have had kids, which we never did. And there was never a choice made, actually. We just sort of like got on with life and then one day sort of realised, oh, I'm maybe getting a bit old, be thinking about that now. And it was never, we were obviously never driven. But I guess that moment in time when we were just getting married and that must have entered my mind, and I was thinking about what kind of world you're bringing your kids into, and I also musically wanted to do something that was very just fun and direct and not complex, to kind of like balance out the album, really. Like I've always loved albums that you're always refreshed with the next thing that's coming at you. You don't know what's going to come next. It's not a load of the same kind of thing. I like that kind of eccentricity and eclecticism.
And you do that, all the way through Danny Wilson's, relatively short-lived kind of career. Both of those records have got those moments on them.
They're a bit mad, aren't they? Let's be honest.
beautifully direct. And I think Make a Family is again, it's one... it just kind of strikes home for me.
I think that's a very honest song. I think it's a really straight song. You get what it's about. It's very clear. It's kind of what we're talking about there.
Absolutely. Okay, so I'm just going to keep moving through. And if there, one of the things I could say, are there songs in there that you particularly stand out for you, Gary, that you're listening back now? You, honest enough to say, you hadn't listened to it for God knows how many years, and then on the car coming here. What were
You've
the ones
covered
that
most of the biggies for me, I would say.
I tell you what I love then. Any Sunday Morning.
Any Sunday Morning. Wow.
And I wondered if you had nursery rhymes in your head when you wrote that song, just the way the structure, da 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 da.
Oh, right.
You know what I mean?
I've never thought about that before, but it might well be.
I didn't attempt to sing it there, but I mean, I could.
No, you're right. The rhythm of it is very much like that. I don't know. I think the melody came to me and the lyric kind of came to me at once. Not the whole lyric, obviously, but it was one of those kind of, some songs you have to work for and some feel like they just drop into your lap. And that was one of those. And lyrically, I had gone to Catholic schools when I was a kid. And the unfortunate thing that I discovered that a lot of, not all of them, I must say, but a lot of the nuns, and actually this is in the movie Sing Street, Christian Brothers and stuff, could actually be very, very, I'm going to avoid the word violent, but rough with kids. And at that time, in the 70s, 60s and 70s, corporal punishment was still a thing. And I saw a lot of nasty things being done to kids, when I was that age, when I was very young, and even in primary school. And there was a particularly sadistic sister that I still remember her name, but I won't say it on the radio, but and she was in my mind when I was writing that song. And why I still think it relates to love, it's about how people express the opposite when you take love away from them, or you tell them that they can only love a god, or they can only love, you know. It was a subject that always sort of fascinated me, why these people who had dedicated their lives to so much, to other people and to religion and to clearly love-based things, that could find anger and frustration that would make them, you know.
And it's another one, Gary, where we just come back to something you were talking about earlier on, about the joy you have in singing and how you express that on this album. Towards the end of it, you've got that sort of almost chorale where all these voices are kind of clashing and all of that. Do you think you found a different voice on this record? Because you always had that kind of soul thing, but on this record, you are singing more like a soul singer. You know, there's more improvisation, there's more pushing the phrasing of it a bit. Is that something you were conscious of?
I don't know if I was conscious of it, but I do agree with what you're saying. It's probably my most soul record of anything that I've done. And the only thing I can say is that because it was a lot of time spent with me sitting at a piano and singing and enjoying singing, as I kind of said earlier, I think that's where it comes from. I think it's just a natural kind of... And I was really inspired at that time as well with overdubbing vocals, and I like the idea of them being really free. Like, I don't plan them out or anything. I'll just try something, and then I'll just overdub another thing, and then I'll overdub another thing, and you get a lot of that looseness, even though it's one person singing. I just like that. It was like painting big sounds with your own voice, you know.
Oh yeah, it's great. It's a lovely way to describe it. Okay, but I said earlier on, maybe put us in the space with you. You know, you've got a studio in your flat. It's actually properly soundproofed and all that. You've got Jed, you've got your sort of core team around you. What was the day-to-day experience working on the record? What did it feel like? What did it look like? What did it sound like?
Well, the flat was a basement flat and had a big long corridor, and the room that was a bedroom that we changed into a studio was at the back. So it was as neighbour-friendly as you could possibly get in a flat, but God help the neighbours. But and we did, you know, we spent money getting it soundproof. It was a room inside a room. And the living room was at the front of the house, and every morning we would start, we would meet at the same time, and we used to watch Neighbours. This is true, right? And I don't know why, but it just became like a ritual that we'd have a cup of coffee and would watch Neighbours. And they used to, with 24-track tape machines, used to get these track sheets. And one of the things that you had to fill in was start time. And start time was like a SMPTE code. Sorry to get technical, but it's a code to tell you the start time where the tape started in time, if you were synchronising something to the tape. And we on all our cue sheets, it actually said start time after Neighbours. So everybody would meet every morning. Carlos would only come sometimes when we were doing percussion, but most of the time it would be me, Jed, Gary Thompson. We'd meet, watch Neighbours, and then we'd go into the studio, and the songs were written, so it was really a matter of working through them. There was one song that wasn't recorded in that process, and it's Baby Blue Number 2. That was a port-to-studio demo, and if you listen to it, I would imagine on headphones, you'd probably hear that we had to use a load of noise reduction and stuff to try and get it to sound to sit on the record. But other than that song, everything else was a matter really of just working through the arrangements. And as you said earlier, I played a lot of the stuff on it myself, so I'd probably started a few demos, I'd probably, you know, to a click or whatever, and it was a very fun, joyous process. Everybody enjoyed it, I think.
What about the when it came out and the aftermath of that? I can't remember, did you do any shows around that record, Gary?
I did. I actually did to reproduce it on stage was going to be either impractical or really, really expensive. So the first thing I did was put together a band, and it was two singers from the London Gospel Community Choir, myself, Boo Hewardine, and Carlos Edwards playing percussion and also singing, because Carlos is a beautiful singer. And it was a very much about the vocals. So it was an acoustic guitar, piano, and five-part harmony. Did I say Boo Hewardine as well?
Yeah, you did Boo say Boo, yeah.
Yeah. And we did a few gigs. We did a radio show. There's some of it's floating around somewhere, I think for the BBC, actually. And the record company realised that it was much cheaper to do it that way. We did three or four gigs. There was one that we did in London, I remember, with a full electric band. Jed was playing bass. Carlos was playing drums. GT was playing, Gary Thompson playing trumpet and keyboards. But most of the gigs that we did was like acoustic with loads of vocals.
Yeah, I was thinking, because Laura Nyro did shows like that around about that time, didn't she? With her and like three singers.
Oh, I didn't see that.
It's a real thing that I think is beautiful when you hear it. It's so distinct from either a solo show or a show with a band. You know, a show that's about the vocals. And I wish
it
I'd
was
seen
a
that
great thing. Thing to do, and it was a great thing to rehearse and to stand in a room and finally sing these songs with other people that had been me tracking myself up. I mean, you need less people when it's actually all different voices. It very quickly gets huge, you know. It's a great sound. And that was a great joy. And also, I guess, for me, it was the proof that the song stood up in a different environment as well, you know.
How does the record stand up for you now when you listen back? What's your feeling on it?
Well, I honestly never go back and listen to stuff. So today I listened to it because I knew we were doing this interview, and I was actually really pleasantly surprised. For me, the production's dated a lot, but I produce all the time, so I'm constantly moving forward. But I don't really hate on it for that, because it is what it is. It kind of captures that moment in time. But I thought that, going back to the songs, I thought I was going to hate them, and I didn't hate them. I thought they were better than I'd somehow in my mind had, you know, come to the conclusion.
And a final question from me, and it's a question I always ask in terms of where you see your music as a piece of Scottish work. Not to be parochial about it, but this is classic Scottish albums, mm-hmm. and. I can think of lots of ways in which I think this is a very Scottish record. Do you have a sense of that? Ever?
I think everything I do is Scottish. Like, but I also think in an international kind of a way. I grew up with a lot of American records, and I've always kind of reached out to the world when I write music. That's kind of the way I feel about it. Even the way I literally sometimes want to say something, whether it's political or just something about love or whatever it is, I'm quite conscious of sort of sending it out into the world. I actually really like the power of music like that, you know? And so I know exactly where it comes from. And as you can hear, I've never lost my accent, even though I've lived all over the planet. There's so much Scottishness in it lyrically. Actually, there's lines, there are northern people who care about me. There's loads and loads of stuff woven through there that's all about who I am and where I come from. But the it's not a Scottish sounding record, but it's deeply in there.
Except insofar as it gives you that other wee link to the Dundee obsession with soul music.
That's very true, and it's
right in the heart of it. And you know, for me, it is a soul record, and it's a record not just soul in terms of the surface noise of it, but in what it says and where it takes you as a listener.
Well, it's great that you say that. And actually, just to, in case people don't know about that whole soul thing that came from Dundee, you know, a lot of the guys from the Average White Band came from that area or went to college around there. And there was other musicians in a whole scene that worked in that field and with them. And there became a band called Mafia, which was Doogie Martin, Jerry McGrath, Donnie Coutts, all brilliant singers, and they used to sing in harmony, which again, Soul Records, three-part harmony. It was in the pubs. You could go and see it in the pubs when I was like 14, 15, 16, because you could go to pubs then. A really early education I got was Dougie Martin asked me to stand in for Jerry McGrath when he was on holiday, and I had to play bass, and I'd never played bass before. And Dougie said, just come up to my flat, and he handed me a bag, a plastic bag, like a supermarket bag, full of classic 60s singles. And he goes, just learn them. And then, and I went back, and it was all Otis Redding and stuff like that, you know. So, in the deep end.
Oh, aye, absolutely. Well, it's a beautiful one to end on. Thanks so much. It's a beautiful thing. It really is.
Thank you so much.
Pleased we're doing it.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Thanks again to Gary for sharing his memories of making our latest classic Scottish album, 10 Short Songs About Love. Next week, I'll let you hear my full conversation with Horse. She'll give us her take on the making of The Same Sky. You'll find all of our episodes on BBC Sounds. Just search for Classic Scottish Albums. I'm Davy Scott. Thanks for listening.